know maybe I'm too late. I could make it there some other time. That's Mac Miller. I'm Blake Murphy. I'm back. And this is Jay's Talk Plus, off last week because of the All-Star break. Thank you to Sho Ali and Julia Kreutz for holding it down. Some really fun shows, some really great guests that they had on as I'm driving around with the AM radio on, which prior to being in this job, I would do all the time. Now a little less so. Missed some stuff. Missed the draft, which was very interesting. Obviously, the Jays, making picks like everyone else on guys that we won't be able to make a determination on for years and years. But some interesting strategy going into that. You know, a pitcher falls in Trey Savage in the first round, a little lower than maybe most people expected. And suddenly your draft strategy shifts to, well, got to get this guy and maybe got to save money with underslot in some other places. The draft played out in interesting fashion. It was fun to watch from afar, read from afar, people's reaction to it. Here, guys like Jeff Ponce, Keith Law is going to come on with us in a minute here and help break down that entire draft. And yeah, soon, you know, in the next month or so, maybe we'll start to see these guys filter in. In the case of Trey Savage, sounds like he could be pretty quick through the minors. So that'll be interesting to track. Some of these other guys that, you know, filter into complex league, maybe Dunedin, if you're a higher end guy. The Jays have been pretty aggressive in the past, sending college hitters right to A with an eye on getting them to high A by their first full pro season. So that was fun. All-Star game and home run derby was fun. Teoscar Hernandez winning and having the time of his life with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was fun. The Blue Jays actual baseball games, maybe a little less fun. I made the Mac Miller quote off the top there. That was kind of about George Springer that, yeah, this is good. It's not George Springer's fault entirely that it's too little too late. It's not him alone that has the Jays 9 games below 500. But his turnaround is kind of into the territory here of, well, something positive to take from a season that is more quickly and more quickly becoming a lost one and more officially being a non-competitive season. Once we get to the trade deadline next week, that'll be very, very clear. It was really fun, though, to see him once again, two home runs and a double yesterday. His season line now, by the way, his OPS has climbed back up above league average. Some of that is due to the league environment, but when you compare his offensive line to the league average, and when you compare his overall production to the replacement level, he is basically on a OPS plus and a wins above replacement level back to where he was last year, maybe even a little better because his defense in right field has graded out so much better. It's been really fun to see. It's probably been the biggest positive of the last month or so. I think June 25th is kind of the turnaround date there for him. That's been awesome to see. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. We're going to give away some Jays tickets a little before 11 o'clock, so stick around with us for that. We're also going to open up the mailbag, so you can text us throughout the show to 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply, which we have to say now. You can text us to 590-590 throughout the show. We'll answer some of your questions in the 10:30 segment today. Ben Nicholson-Smith is going to join us in studio for the 11 o'clock hour. And like I said, Keith Law is going to join us momentarily. The Jays don't play today. They are coming off two series losses. The book ended the All-Star break. They obviously lost to the Arizona Diamondbacks, some of those in very unsightly fashion. And then a competitive series with the Tigers this weekend, but a 5-4 loss on Friday, shakier Chris Bassett outing than we've seen throughout this year. It was a fun game where Vlad and Springer both homered, but the Bo Bichette calf injury news comes down later that game. He is going to be out multiple weeks with a moderate calf sprain. So get used to seeing Leo Jimenez and Ernie Clement in there. Saturday, they lose 7-5 to those Tigers. Yusei Kikuchi looking good in what is potentially his last start as a Blue Jay until leaves a couple runners for Trevor Richards, gives up a grand slam, and then things unravel in a 6-run 6 there. Vlad did homer for a third consecutive game in that one. And then a 5-4-1 win yesterday. That was basically all George Springer. Two home runs and a double coming around to score on that double as well. Chad Green coming up with a 5-out save. The day-to-day game stuff is probably not front of mind for you right now with the trade deadline 8 days away. Let's take a look at where this org is. Let's take a look at last week's draft as well. We're joined now by Keith Law of The Athletic. Keith, good morning. How are we doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I got to ask you the question that is front of mind for everyone when they talk to Keith Law around MLB draft season, and that is, why are cooperative board games so hot right now?
Yeah, it was a big weekend for cooperative board games. Actually, maybe people just want a kinder, gentler tabletop experience.
Not me. Give me war in there, Keith. Okay, Keith. It was obviously, this is draft time. This is very busy for you. What is the process like for you coming out of those 3 days of the draft? Obviously, you have to sit down. I know at The Athletic, you do a pretty substantial write-up on every team's draft through the first 2 days, American League section, National League section. What is that process like, sitting down and going through each draft, trying to contextualize, where these guys are in the team's farm systems, where these farm systems are relative to each other?
Well, to me, the most important thing is to say, even if it's just a sentence, on every pick, I really focus on the top 10 rounds, because rounds 11 through 20 is usually about just filling out my early rosters. But give the reader one sentence on anybody who looks like a prospect. Sometimes teams say college seniors, or now we have fifth-year seniors and grad students because of COVID. Those guys are much less likely to be prospects. So I really try to drill down on the guys who look like they were drafted because someone thought they were prospects. Give the most information on the higher picks or the higher ranked guys from my top 100 coming into the draft. And then as I go through each team, if a picture emerges, a more big picture observation emerges, then I include it. Sometimes teams drafts seem to lean in a certain direction. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes it looks like a team we're just going to take the best player available at each pick. And so that means they don't have maybe an overarching theme, but that's fine. I just want to give, I figure most of these, you're a fan of Team X, you want to see what I said about their draft picks. So I just want to make sure I'm giving as good quality information as I can, given the fact that I have to write up, 250 players, some ridiculous number.
It is a ridiculous number, but it's fun to see the work as well, and then read a name and then be like, well, I immediately forgot that name because I just read 250 of them. But Eddie Micheletti is going to stick in my head for forever now. The only college senior signing you really cared to. For anyone who didn't see it, Eddie Micheletti was a senior sign that the Jays took in the first 10 rounds, and Keith mentioned him because he's from your hood.
Yes. I know Eddie. He went to the same high school that my kids went to /go to, which they've never had a player reach the majors, so that would be kind of fun if he got there. And I thought Eddie was going to be a day three pick. I figured someone would take him. He transferred to Virginia Tech and had a great season. But he's a college senior, and he's a bat first, and those guys typically, if they get drafted, it's 11 through 20. So when I didn't even know at the time. I was just going through each team's draft, and I looked, and I said, an expletive, holy something. And he got drafted, and immediately texted my wife, my daughter, et cetera, because that's big news around our park.
Yeah, that's it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Obviously, we keep an eye on the Canadian guys here in Canada, and you get excited to see Emilian Petrie go to Tampa Bay, or Fluelling actually also go to Tampa. Tampa Bay just stack Canadian prospects.
Must be the new inefficiency.
Apparently, if the Rays are doing it, we got to stay on top of it. So Keith, at the higher end of the draft, it felt pretty wide open at number one. I know you only thought there were two guys, fully worthy of that number one pick, but overall in the first round, 25 of those top 30 picks were guys ranked in your top 31. Are you just that good, or is this, is this indicative of what this draft was? Maybe even just something like, well, in the information age here, like everyone's working off a pretty similar draft ranking at that point in the year.
Yeah, it was pretty chalk, and I would even go even a little further than that too. That one of the guys who wasn't ranked in my top 31, Christian Moore, who went 8th overall to the Angels. I fully admit I'm kind of the low guy. I don't buy it. It's a separate conversation. But even he, the lowest ranked guy by my board taken in the top 10, there are a lot of people who would argue, no, he absolutely belonged up there. It was a first round with very few surprises. I think there were two guys taken in the top 30 where I actually could say I was surprised. Like, I didn't expect to hear that name called that early. They were prospects. They were on my top 100. But if you'd asked me that morning, does this guy go in the first round? I would have said almost certainly not. And that's a low number. I mean, we've had years where guys are taken in the top 30 who were completely off my top 100, MLB's top 100, Fangraphs top 100. We didn't have any of that this year, which is, maybe there's a consolidation of, we're all working from a lot of the same information. I think also this was just such a college-heavy draft, and you get fewer surprises in years like that.
Which makes some sense. So one of those surprises was a kind of Canadian, Dante Norrie, who was born, he wasn't raised here, but we had his dad, former Toronto Raptors assistant coach and current Minnesota Timberwolves assistant coach, Micah Norrie, on the show last week while I was off. So Dante Norrie goes to Philadelphia at 27. You had him ranked 65. You and I talked a little bit about him before the draft. Why do you think that is, that he ended up going in the first when most people seem to see him as a late second to, you know, third, maybe even fourth round pick?
Well, so he went to the Phillies, who are, you know, I talk a lot about model heavy teams that draft from a draft model. I believe the Blue Jays would be included in that for sure. Cleveland is a very heavy draft model team. The Phillies are the dead opposite. If you put together a spectrum of how much teams rely on a draft model, I think the Phillies would be all the way at the other end. And that matters because Norrie's very talented athlete, can really run. There might be some power in there that someone can have to unlock. But he is 19 and change. I think he's past 19 and a half already. And in a draft model, that's going to kill you as a high school player. Those teams, because the history of 19-year-old high school players drafted high is just worse than it is for players who are 18 or younger. There are success stories. JT Realmuto is probably the best one in the majors right now. He was also 19 and a half when he was drafted. So most teams will shy away from those guys or just race them lower, again, in the draft model, so that they just get picked by somebody else. Well, the Phillies are probably the most old-school drafting team there is. They've gone five straight years with a high school player in the first round, and they've hit on a couple of them, so I'm not going to tell you it's a bad approach. Maybe if everyone's going one direction, there's some value in being a bit of a contrarian going the other way. But given Norrie's age and the fact that he plays in Michigan, which is not a high-caliber high school baseball, yeah, that was certainly the biggest surprise in the first round for me.
Well, we'll be rooting for him here. This is a hard pivot here. It has nothing to do with Dante Norrie, but I'm curious. So Paul Skeens obviously goes number one last year and reaches the majors right away and is starting the All-Star game a calendar year after he was drafted. When you do hits like this, or you're doing podcasts at The Athletic or wherever else, how much do you think the Paul Skeens success has warped what people are now anticipating as a timeline? Like, I want to acknowledge too that, like, with fewer minor league levels, with, you know, the concentration of baseball talent being more heavily concentrated in a few power conferences, like, it does make some sense that some guys will move a little quicker. But have you gotten a sense of maybe the Paul Skeens experience is going to warp patience levels with paths to the majors?
I mean, the first thing I've noticed is people were a lot more interested in the draft in the last week or so, right? Skeens blowing up like he has. I think it's generally increased interest in the draft, and it was convenient that I've complained all year that this was not a good draft class. However, it was a very college-heavy draft class, and guess what? Those guys are going to get to the majors a lot faster. So when people have had me on, and everyone wants to talk about Skeens, which is fun. He's super fun. But then, okay, who's this year's Paul Skeens? Well, rather than just me being Debbie Downer and saying there's no more Paul Skeens, nobody's like him, he's a unicorn, et cetera, I can pivot and say, hey, look, there's a bunch of college guys in this draft who are probably going to get to the majors in a year and change. And they may not light the league on fire, but they're going to get there fast. And I think it helps emphasize the relevance of the draft, even to casual fans who don't care as much about prospects or maybe aren't fantasy players. They just want to know about guys who are going to be in the big leagues and when are they showing up. I mean, this year, we do have a lot of that. First high school player was drafted 9th overall. That's the lowest in history for that to happen.
That's pretty incredible. 9th overall for the highest high school. And this is, you know, maybe a more natural pivot to the Toronto Blue Jays draft, where they had a pitcher who was number 3 among pitchers on your board slide to number 20 in Treya Savage, who one of the selling points is he might be one of the more quick through the minor leagues pitchers in this draft. What did you make of Treya Savage sliding to 20, first of all, and then the Jays scooping him up there when he did?
Yeah, well, it's great pick for where they chucked in. And I think if they were contenders, they could even try to bring him to the majors this year for some kind of limited role. I think they're not contenders or not close enough to rush him like that. But I do think they got a very quick to the majors mid-rotation start, right? You're picking 20. At that point, you're either going for big ceiling or you're going for probability. You're probably not going to get a lot of both. And I think here they went for probability. It's low to mid-90s. On a strike, out pitch of a splitter, one of the best pure, just straight up swing miss pitches in the draft class this year. Why did he slide? Well, one, it's not a great delivery. It's an extremely short arm action. I have yet to find a good comparison among a major league starter who pitches like that. We did have a lot of short arm actions in the draft this year. I think it's a little bit of a trend that way, and it remains to be seen whether that's a positive or not. The other thing is he had a weird injury in May. He was getting this pseudoscience treatment called dry needling and ended up with a punctured lung. And that took him out for a couple of weeks. And I am sure that caused some teams to hesitate, particularly in that sort of 11 to 19 range where everyone thought he was going to get drafted. That's to the Jays' benefit. I don't think that injury is supposed to have any long-term effects. And it gives them, you know, like I said, I think a pretty quick to the major start. I think if you're taking Trey Savage because you think he's in the big leagues by this time next year or, you know, give or take a couple of weeks.
Well, that'd be exciting, and that is helpful information. I've had dry needling on a ligament injury in my elbow before, and guess what ligament it still gives me issues sometimes, Keith?
That one in the elbow? Possibly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not throwing 95, so it's not too big a concern, but we're all right there. So with respect to that, I could have seen, like, obviously that injury and the time he missed is relevant, and that's time the teams didn't get to see him and things like that. But then he also, you know, probably could have just shut it down, but he gets back and he does face Chase Burns in that regional game against Wake Forest. The teams put a value in that, or is it just too murky an injury to really take anything of him making it back for that big outing?
Well, I think the value in that is that he obviously wanted to come back and pitch, right? And he showed up for his team. You know, you want to see some competitiveness. You want to see the player to have that drive to return. I mean, to me, sometimes the best stories are the player really wanted to come back, but the team doctor said no, and so we decided not to use him, right? That's sort of a win all around. Everyone was cautious, did the right thing for the player, but also the kid showed he was really competitive and he wanted to get out there. There's a player I won't name who was drafted high this year, and the comment from a teammate was he really likes the trainer's room. You don't want to hear that. The amount of money that we're getting these kids as just obviously just these bonuses and the expectations for them and honestly the difficulty of getting up the minor league ladder at this point. You want a kid who's got that drive and that competitiveness. And I mean, Savage was already that guy. This just underscored something we already knew.
So with respect to Savage, the Jays took Arjun Namala at 20 last year. He slotted in, I think, fourth in their org rankings when you did your latest prospect rankings after that draft. What are we looking at from Savage, whether it's, you know, where he slots in the Jays organization or where he'd slot into, you know, not a top 100, obviously, as a number 20 overall pick, but, you know, a theoretically expanded top prospects list?
Yeah, I guess if I went to about, I'm just like spitballing here, but 150, he would certainly be on there, because although he was the 20th pick in the draft, I had him ranked higher without any new information to change that. He would probably be somewhere in that like 101, 150 range. So I would put him third or fourth in the system. I'd have him behind Namala. He's played really well since he returned to low A. Big ceiling guy. I loved the pick when they made it last year, also pick 20. You know, very different sorts of prospects, right? Namala's still only 18. He's got big upside. You Savage, college guy, gets there faster, probably lower ceiling. Given Namala's, especially his bounce back performance, I'm more inclined to lean with the higher ceiling. But also with Ricky Tiedemann hurt yet again, is you Savage maybe the best pitching prospect in the system now? I probably lean towards yes. And I don't, they didn't draft for need necessarily, but it is nice when the best player available also happens to fill a pretty big need in the organization.
Yeah, it's and Adam Matko, the maybe next candidate for best pitching prospect in the system, is injured as well. So Landon Moraitis, Brandon Barriera, they're all hurt. So Trey Savage just needs to stay healthy for a little bit here. Okay, so outside of that first round, they stayed pretty pitcher heavy early on. They take Carl Steven in the second round, big strike thrower. They take Johnny King in the third round, who's on the opposite end of Savage and Stefan, in that he's very, very young and projectability. What did you make of the Jays draft overall across those first 2 days?
It looks conservative, and I'm not saying that as a criticism. They lean college. It's a college-heavy draft anyway. It looked like they were trying to get some certainty into the system, just get some more immediate value. Right? One of the things about college players is you have a higher degree of certainty in what they're going to be, that, you know, which means a narrower range of outcomes. Maybe you don't have quite the upside. That's typically true of college players, especially after the first round. But if you're trying to get a big influx of any talent in the system of guys who project to some sort of major league role, you go college. And I think I would say they did that. I did not love their draft. Obviously, they didn't have, they didn't have like extra picks anywhere to get creative with the money. They just sort of had the straight one pick in every round. That limited the flexibility a little bit, but I will say, I thought Yusavage was a great pick. I think King is really interesting. He's a one prep guy. I think they took him in the top 10 rounds. Interesting upside play, good spot to go for a high school pitcher. Other than that, though, I think they got a sort of lot of low ceiling guys that will make the system look a little better next year. There'll be more probability, but there's only one guy in there who's got a chance to, I think, really impact the major league club, and that's Yusavage.
Yeah, that which is, that seems to be par for the course for the last couple of drafts. One big swing, and the last two drafts with Namala and Barriera being the big swings, and then a lot of projectability and things like that. Did want to ask you about two guys in that kind of late second day. Aaron Parker, you kind of gave the impression he's a Alejandro Kirk clone there, like a 5'8", 5'9" catcher, really good hands for the bat to ball, a decent pop time. Do you see a path for him, or is the question with an undersized catcher like that is always, the athleticism at the position to translate. Do you like the flyer on Aaron Parker?
Yeah, I think he's going to have to prove it at every level that he's got that he's going to be able to continue to hit and be able to continue to handle the position. I mean, that's one of the spots on the diamond where you can be that size and that build, right? He is short, but he is drafted is the word I use to describe him. He's a little more full-figured, but that's fine as a catcher. He's just going to have to continue to hit and stay healthy as he moves up the ladder, right? You worry about a guy who's maybe a little heavier for his height, about his ability to, say, avoid back problems and avoid knee problems, especially at a position where guys just get the tar kicked out of them. It's just such a toll on the body. But I did think it was in the sixth round to take a bat-to-ball guy who's got a real good chance to stay behind the plate. Talking about floor again, right? Talking about probability. Really good chance you've got a backup catcher there. Maybe he ends up in something more. Catchers do also develop a little bit later because of the strain on them and the amount of work required. But in the sixth round, if I told you in the sixth round you're getting a major league backup catcher, you are very happy with that outcome. And I think he's got actually a pretty good chance to get that.
Which is, that it's helpful context because, like, a lot of these picks, once we're talking about sixth, seventh, eighth, 15th rounders, like, if this guy pitches like 10 innings of relief for you at some point, that's a win for that draft pick. I will use that to pivot to their seventh round pick. Austin Cates, obviously not standout numbers or anything like that. When the impression you gave is like, this is a guy with a changeup and everything else is just sort of there. Do you like that? And again, it skews a little more conservative because my read from your write-up and other people's write-ups is like, okay, if this guy hits, it's probably as a reliever with one big weapon. But at that point, you just pick for, hey, this guy has one very obvious skill. Let's see if we can build enough around that. Do you find that to be a reasonable gamble at that point in the draft, or is the seventh round a little early?
Yeah, in the seventh round, your case. So I described Cates as having a plus changeup and, arguably plus control. If you see a pitcher with one plus pitch in the seventh round, a college guy in particular, yeah, that's a no-brainer. To me, that is absolutely good value at the spot because at worst, you'd like to think that'll get him just the plus pitch and the fact he throws a lot of strikes will get into the upper minors. And that's on player development to see if there's something more there. His fastball's a little light, both in velocity and the secondary characteristics, but maybe you can add strength. Maybe you can add velocity. Hey, maybe he gets in the Pro Bowl. It turns out that changeup is, I think it's plus. It turns out it's been better than that, and he advances a little sooner. There's a lot of different ways that this can go, but you're starting with a decent foundation of one plus pitch. So to me, again, perfectly reasonable guy to take in the seventh round where your expected value at a pick like that is zero. The expected major league value of picks after about the fifth round or so is pretty much zero. If the guy spends a couple of days in the big league, you won. And so to me, at that spot in the draft, they do like the fact that the Jays were still taking college juniors, whereas a lot of teams at that point are just college senior, college senior, college senior, trying to save money to move it around in the draft. There might be guys out there who could still get to the big leagues. And the Jays were one of about a half dozen teams, I would say, that were still doing that. They're still going after college juniors who might have a little bit more potential as opposed to just saving money.
Which is nice. I mean, they've got to be able to get some arms into the system and develop them at some point, because as we've talked about, the farm system is a little bit thin. So the draft is one way to do that, and Keith, making trades as a seller at the deadline is the other way to do that. I know you and I have talked about the awkwardness of this trade deadline where a potential lame duck GM is operating it. Let's put that aside for now, because that is a bigger discussion in 8 days. They're not changing the general manager 8 days before the trade deadline, I don't think. If so, the second hour of this show today is going to be much more interesting.
Twitter wants them to.
Yeah, I mean, people were chanting it at the game on Friday, too. I don't know that I would, like, at this point, you're 8 days out. It's just not happening. So let's focus on the trade deadline as is. So the Jays have mostly held, at least in terms of what they've leaked, that, yeah, they're willing to listen on anyone who's not nailed down. So anyone who's an expiring contract after this year, Kikuchi, Garcia, Richards, Jansen, Turner, Kiermaier, whoever else. But guys who are under contract beyond this year are not, they say they're not available. We'll see. But if they hold to that, given what we know about what actually comes back for a good rental starting pitcher, a good rental reliever and things like that, is that going to be enough to really move the needle on the farm strength here, Keith? Like, how well do they have to nail these trades for only a modest sell-off to really make a difference in the farm quality?
I would look at the Mets last year, right, where the Mets traded a bunch of guys, mostly who were expiring contracts. I think they might have traded one or two guys who had, right, didn't Scherzer have one plus left at that point. So there was, and they had paid a ton of his salary to make that trade. The Mets got a lot of volume, but only one guy who ended up on my offseason top 100. Not that that's the only metric we should use, but I just think that's a good sort of back of the envelope way to look at how much high ceiling did they get. They got one guy, and they made five or six trades of veterans, mostly on expiring contracts. That's kind of what I'm thinking. I mean, even just listening to you rattle off that list of names, you're not getting big impacts back, I think, for any of those guys. Also, I'm completely fine with them saying, maybe they're not saying this publicly, but Bichette, he's hurt. You're not getting any, having a bad season. You're not getting anything for him right now. Vlad, they don't want to trade him right now. You know what? Explore the market for him in the offseason. You can get more bidders involved in trades in the winter than you can in July. Teams have more room in the budget. A lot of teams are deluding themselves into thinking they're contenders when they're actually not. Much harder to do that in July when you look at the standings from 10 games out. So I'm fine with them taking that strategy, but you've got to recognize too, if you get a top 100-ish prospect or somebody comparable like that, you got lucky. You just caught a GM who was willing to overpay because he was trying to save his job or something similar to that.
So it's probably fair to say the likelier, again, Kikuchi, Garcia, Richards, Jansen, whichever pieces move, it's likelier that, it's especially given the conservative nature of this front office in the past, it's probably likelier you're restocking the depth more than like really moving the upside then.
Yeah, I'd say that's exactly right. Now, this is a situation too where you got to lean on your pro scouts and your R&D department too, but this is where the pro scouts make their money, right? You are looking for the lower level guy to. It's an opportunity, right? Who's the guy who's undervalued by the team that has him? Who's the guy where you look at and say, there's one small change we can make here and just make him a better player. They're probably not going to make him a superstar, but find some value in these trades where the other team doesn't, to put it a little simply, they don't know what they're giving up, right? The Rays got Junior Caminero, who's now the number three prospect in baseball on my list, for Tobias Myers, an absolute throwaway of a trade, and the guy ends up being the Rays' best prospect. And if you ask the Rays people, it was their scouts who did it.
Yeah, which is, that's what the Rays have done particularly well about. And the Tobias Myers thing is fascinating because, like, he looked like that looked like a particularly bad trade for a long time. And then obviously the Guardians are not the ones getting the benefit of this, but now having a pretty good season as like a kind of post-hype rookie here for the Brewers.
Yep. Yeah, he didn't stink. That was the funny thing is, this guy was a prospect, first in the Baltimore system, and then Cleveland picked him up, and they sort of gave up on him oddly quickly. I mean, that whole story is bizarre. To trade him for a DSL guy who, I think, Cleveland, and this is very unlike them, they actually didn't know what they had.
Yeah, I guess it's tough with guys at that age and in that competitive environment. Keith, before I let you go, one of the things that I noticed when you were providing blurbs around The Athletic for the other writers there, as you do, and writing up each team's draft, you mentioned that, as usual, the Reds had one of your favorite draft classes. I'm not super interested in the Reds prospects specifically, who they picked up, but that kind of consistency of, hey, they're usually on my radar as a team that drafts well. What goes into that? Like what teams are the better drafting teams the last couple of years, and what do you look for when you say something like that?
So I'll answer the second question first. You know, what I'm looking for, the most objective way I can do this, I rank 100 players, and I write up usually 20 to 30 more before the draft actually takes place. And so just comparing who they took and where they took them to where I have these guys ranked. That's the simplest way for, otherwise everyone's going to complain I hate their team, right? But here I can just point and say, no, look where I had these guys ranked and look where they were selected. It looks like they got consistently good value. The Reds are also one of those teams, like the Jays were this year, where they just keep drafting prospects all the way through the top 10 or very close to the end of the top 10. And so I tend to like that as well. And I do think the Reds just as it works out, they seem to value players a bit like I value players. They have a lot more information than I do, but we look at the world kind of through a similar lens. The one thing that the best drafting teams tend to have in common, though, is that they use a blended model of scouting and R&D, and they just about all have large scouting staff. The Reds do, the Dodgers do, the Rays do. The teams that have maintained scouting post-pandemic, I think, have a huge advantage in the draft. And we do see a lot of the teams that have really cut down on scouting, particularly the Astros, struggling in the draft, especially once they're not drafting top 10. It would be very interesting to see what the Orioles do now that they're not drafting first or second or fifth anymore. It's a very different world when your first pick is at the end of the first round. And by the way, you have a really tiny scouting staff that's making a lot of your picks just off the model.
Okay, Keith, I said that was the last question. I do have one quick one for you before I let you go here. And sorry, I've taken up a lot of your time. But Rob Manfred got asked about, over All-Star Weekend, about the potential for teams to, in a future CBA, be able to trade away draft picks. Would you enjoy that wrinkle, or would you prefer it under the current system?
Oh, no. We should. I wrote a column 18 years ago for ESPN arguing for trading of draft picks. And I also don't think it's going to happen, because I've said this before. I apologize if I said this on your show before. It has to be collectively bargained.
Yeah.
And so both sides, league and union, have to agree to it. And this is what's going to happen. One of them is going to bring it up, and the other side is going to say, all right, what are you going to give me in return? And then the first side is going to say nothing, and that's going to be the end of it.
Neither side cares enough about it to make it a negotiating point. So, yeah.
It really doesn't benefit either side enough. The people who want this the most are the 30 general managers, and they have no say in the collective bargaining. And I promise you, Rob Manfred really doesn't care what the 30 general managers think. He only cares what the 30 owners think, because they're the ones that pay his salary.
I would love it. I would absolutely love to be a fly on the wall as two general managers haggle over, should I get a 17th or an 18th back in this trade? Keith Law, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Thanks for all the great work around draft season.
Yep, my pleasure.
Keith Law of The Athletic. Again, big write-ups on every team over the first 2 days, those first 10 rounds of the draft over at The Athletic, an American League portion, a National League portion. A lot of good detail on everyone the Jays drafted over those first 10 rounds. Ben Nicholson-Smith is going to join us in studio for the second hour of the show. For this next segment, after we take a break here, we're going to open up the mailbag and take a bunch of your questions. You haven't got to talk to me in a week and a half here. You probably don't have much. We all know what the table is set like for the next 8 days. So maybe there's not a ton new, but fire away anyway to 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will open up that mailbag, 590-590. As Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Toronto Blue Jays dropped 2 of 3, but a fun one, a fun series generally, and a fun one yesterday. We're going to have Ben Nicholson-Smith in studio for the second hour of the show to talk all sorts of trade deadline stuff because, yeah, that's 8 days away. That is Tuesday, July the 30th. We will be, get this, 4 hours that day. So last year we expanded the hours of the show. So the show's 10 to 12. Last year we expanded it to 9 to 12. And I'm not lying. I'm not misremembering this. We did not get even like the hint of a rumor during those 3 hours. So we're going to try a different approach. We're going to do 10 to 2 next Tuesday, and we are going to cross our fingers for a little bit of a juicier. I mean, the deadline wasn't boring, but nothing happened during our show last year. So this coming deadline, we'll hope for a little bit more. We'll hope that action gets going a little earlier in the day. The trade deadline is not until 6 o'clock. So Blair and Barker will be on with you to take you through that. Ailish and Justin will bridge us 2 to 4 there. But yeah, we'll have basically wall-to-wall trade deadline coverage. And selfishly, I hope that trades happen in the morning. The Jays will also be coming off of a doubleheader in Baltimore the day before. So we're going to have a lot of our Sportsnet people down in Baltimore. Obviously, we'll have them join us, including Ben Nicholson-Smith, throughout that four-hour show. But I'm looking forward to that. Just really, really crossing my fingers we get a little bit more juice than last year's expanded trade deadline show. So Ben's joining us 11. Right now, we're going to take some of your texts from 590, 590. Standard message and data rates may apply if you text us. But let's see what is in the mailbag. Jordan from Vancouver asks a fun one that I should probably have one of those pitch design, pitch modeling sports scientist guys on to discuss. He asks, what are your thoughts on a one-seam fastball, and do you think more players should be throwing it? So for anyone who doesn't know, four-seam fastball, the standard fastball, two fingers across the seams at two different points. Two-seam fastball is the sinker style, so those ones that if you're a righty, kind of whip back in toward a right-handed hitter. Now, there are different variations of a two-seam or a sinker. You know, some dive, some ride, some come in at a hitter, some have flat movement horizontally and things like that. There is also a one-seamer, and the one-seamer is tough to evaluate, tough to get a handle on, because a few pitchers have thrown it over the years, and you can pick up, if you're one of those guys who know, or one of those people rather, who know how to look at the StatCast stuff, look at the RPMs, the spin access, access all that data, you can tell that it's a one-seamer. But for our purposes, StatCast and MLB Game Day and stuff like that, they just pick it up usually as a two-seamer. So Kevin Gausman, for example, has always thrown the fastball, the four-seam fastball on the splitter and a slider. Last year, he toys with the sweeper. This year, as I wrote about early in the year, he reintroduces the two-seamer, which he used to throw back in Baltimore, but it shelved for a couple years. If we look into the like really nitty-gritty data, we can see that, hey, some of these aren't four-seamers or two-seamers or splitters. They're one-seamers. So Kevin Gausman's a guy who's toyed with it. Joe Musgrove is, I think, pretty famously the guy who has thrown a one-seam sinker. And then, you know, this is something that Driveline, you know, those guys. So Kyle Bowdy, who is, I believe he's with the Red Sox as a consultant now, but I'm sure you've heard of Driveline. They've worked on one-seamers and things like that. And, you know, so when you look at all the different types of four-seamers, two-seamers, cutters, things like that, they have this unique spin axis, a one-seamer. Now, as to Jordan's actual question about whether more people should throw it, I mean, clearly I'm still learning about that. The seam shifted wake, there is a good argument from a physics perspective as to why a one-seamer would be effective. At this point in 2024, I kind of think if it were teachable enough, if enough guys could throw it, more guys would be throwing it because it would be effective based on what we know about seam shifted wake and stuff like that. Anyway, it's something to watch for because as with all of these, you know, advancements that we make on the pitching side with pitch tracking, pitch modeling and things like that, someone's going to figure it out if there's even 0.0001% of an edge to gain on a hitter. So it might be something, Jordan, where more people are starting to throw it or are throwing it, and we're just not capturing it and bidding it right on StatCast and things like that. But yeah, something fascinating to look at. And you can go, there's a Fangraphs article, I don't know, a couple years ago with Joe Musgrove, where he went through the different grips and kind of showed you what his one seamer looks like. And it's two fingers on either side of one seam, and then they don't touch, obviously, another part of the seam horseshoe. So it'll be interesting to see. It'd be interesting to see if teams can teach that and if pitchers can learn it and, you know, have a release profile that doesn't give it away and things like that. What do we got? Pat in Brantford. Oh, I kind of asked this to Keith Law because Pat had asked it. Would love to hear your thoughts on Rob Manfred talking about going forward, possibly being able to trade draft picks. I would love it. I joked that it would be really funny to, like, you're at the deadline on like a Hennessy Cabrera type trade and you're arguing over it. Actually, you can't do this unless I get a 17th back. Well, 18th is all we're willing to go. That stuff would be fun and kind of silly, but no, the ability to move a high-end pick, and obviously you can move certain competitive balance picks in the current environment, but it would be fun. I think it would be cool. I think it adds interest to the draft. I think, you know, some of the prospects we're going to get back here at the trade deadline are not going to move the needle a ton, and even if that high A fringy prospect 2 years after draft is actually a better prospect than who you get with the next draft pick 3 years down the line, it's still always interesting to have the extra draft picks and get to talk about that and stuff. It just adds an extra element to trade too. To Keith's point, it's hard to see it getting collectively bargained, although I will say there's probably a slight argument that the players, both the players union and the owners could come to, I mean, both sides would probably be fine with it. I could see either side caring about it now enough to leave something else off the table. Keith's probably right. But you know, if you're the ownership group, the ability to acquire more draft picks because you're a cheap team and want to be able to build that way. If you're a richer team and you would like to be able to trade for players without thinning out your farm system, so you're the Dodgers and you don't want to trade, you know, from your top 10 system while also being competitive, I think that would suit a lot of different team types. And then from the player perspective, you know, the minor league union doesn't have a huge seat at the table. We're still working on that, but I could see the minor league union being like, yeah, if we could trade draft picks, then minor leaguers would have like a thread of more stability around trades and stuff like that. Giacomo in Windsor says, welcome back. What do you think of Clement currently and his future on the 2025 roster? I think it's good. I think it's good that he's been able to show the last little bit that he can be more than just a fastball hitter. He had that two homer series where one came off, you know, a changeup really, really low in the zone that never gets hit for a home run. He had a home run off a breaking ball as well. You know, he's mostly been a pure fastball hitter and a really aggressive one. And Chris Black and I have talked about this, that's a good profile for a bench guy where you have to come in once or twice a week and really take advantage and, you know, stay fresh and stay ready and things like that. I think it's good he's been able to show a little bit more that he can hit different pitch types, that he's not as predictable as that. You know, there's a decent enough hit tool there. I would love to see some of that aggression, some of that bat to ball, you know, produce better than a 286 OBP. But as far as a bench guy goes, being able to play solid to plus defense at a couple different positions, have a good bat to ball profile like that, have some extra base power, I certainly think, you know, you have him in pencil for a 2025 roster spot. It's probably a reserve spot, but you know, he's probably played his way from, hey, he's the 13th man to, you know, maybe he's the 10th or 11th man, at least for right now. Look, you're in a situation as the Blue Jays where you're going to have to look at upgrading every spot, even if you like a guy and he's had a good season. But Ernie's had a good season. He's delivered on a lot of what the question marks were heading into this year. Aaron in Toronto said, I know your guest said none of the Blue Jays trade chips can land you a top 100 prospect, but what if they combine two players to one team? Yeah, Aaron, I mean, that's a possibility. Like Keith said, there's also a possibility that, you know, that he's wrong. It only takes one GM to give up a guy. You know, maybe the Blue Jays see a guy who's in the 150 to 200 range as a top 100 prospect, maybe vice versa. A team has a top 100 guy that they don't think is a top 100 guy. The top 100 cutoff is vague. I think what you're trying to look at is, you know, can you get a guy who's in the top five in a solid farm systems rankings, that kind of thing. But yes, the ability to pair two guys together in a trade, you know, a team that has needs in both the rotation and the bullpen, maybe it's a Kikuchi and Garcia, a team that wants Kikuchi and, hey, Justin Turner back as a bat would be great. In those trades, you're probably talking about eating money. This is another way that you can improve the prospect return. We use the Mets as an example in that conversation. The Mets ate a ton of money and that improved the prospect capital coming back. They still didn't, you know, change dramatically the top end of their farm system, but eating money goes a long way. And the Jays are in an interesting spot with it. We talked about this when they waived Kevin Kiermaier, which was just to see if someone would take that contract. The Jays are like $10 or $11 million from being able to duck below the competitive balance tax. And that has an impact on what draft pick you give up if you sign a free agent who was given a qualifying offer. It changes what compensation pick you get back if one of your free agents, if you offer them a qualifying offer and they leave. So a Danny Jansen or Yusei Kikuchi, if you don't trade them, it has an impact on what you're paying in terms of tax percentage next year, which again, I know fans don't really care about Rogers spending the money, but if we assume that they're operating under a budget, you know, next year's tax rate being 50% instead of 20% is a pretty big difference in terms of how far Rogers' money would go if you're spending. So I think all of those things are relevant, but I would lean as a bigger market team with big pockets toward, you know, use your money to get a better trade return. If you got to eat a couple mil on Kiermaier, on Turner, on whoever, that's part of the benefit of being a big market team is what if that you don't want to ever have to sell, but when you do have to sell, you can use a little bit of your money to get a better prospect return. Like we saw with, if you go way back to, hey, Drew Hutchison for Francisco Liriano and a pair of prospects who became Harold Ramirez and Reese McGuire. That was a financially motivated trade for Pittsburgh. You can do those things. Kevin from Toronto asks, what happens to Kiermaier and Justin Turner if they can't find a trade partner? I'd imagine they're not the most sought after players on their contracts. Yeah, it's interesting. The answer is it probably depends on what other trades happen. If the Blue Jays don't do anything else, you know, maybe you could see Kevin Kiermaier getting placed on waivers again to see if someone would claim that contract. Justin Turner, I think you'd probably just keep. Like, he's a good, Kiermaier's a good clubhouse guy too. And this is the thing where, like, if you have traded other pieces, well, someone's got to take these at bats. The AAA team is not flush with, like, Addison Barger's up now, Leo Jimenez, Ernie Clement, Spencer Horwitz, David Schneider. Like, they're all here. Stuart Brewer, they're all here. There aren't that many guys anymore knocking on the door. As much as I'd love to see Gabriel Cancel up here, and he's cooled off a little bit, you know, yeah, you could give Rafael Antigua, Will Robertson a look, Phil Clark a look, whatever. You could give those guys a look, but someone's going to have to fill those 13 roster spots. I don't think they'd necessarily be in a hurry to dump those guys just because. Now, if one of those guys comes to you and says, hey, I'd like to, you know, see if I can catch on as a post-trade DFA signing for a team, I'd appreciate it. You want to do right by the players and things like that. But yeah, it's an interesting question, Kevin. It's hard to see them just letting Turner go just for the sake of it. Kiermaier, given that they placed him on waivers already, I wonder if they'd do it again to see if someone, and keep in mind too, you know, Kiermaier makes $10.5 million. That's $4.5 million if a team claims him today. A month from now, that's only $2.5 million, right? So the cost for a team claiming him decreases as we go along here as well. Craig in Scarborough says, assuming some changes happen to the current starting pitching roster, who's next up? It's Bowden Francis. He is back down in AAA, getting stretched back out as a starter. Had a really good four-inning start the other day. He's a guy who, you know, I think they're still interested in seeing if he can become a starter. The addition of the splitter, you know, it's a decent splitter. That should help you deal with lefties, give you another weapon if you're seeing a lineup the second time through. Bowden Francis had such a weird year with his role changing and injuries and stuff like that. I know some of this probably sounds like me having been high on him and trying to recoup some of that. I still think he could be like your number six, number seven starter type. Obviously, you'll run out of options at a certain point. But he's back down there getting stretched out. So he's going to get the next shot, I'm pretty sure. Someone who didn't sign there has asked, where do I see Spencer Horwitz as a position player, first or second? Probably both. Like, he's better at first than he is at second. He's going to top out as average at second. But that flexibility, that ability to do that is huge. Like, if you run it, look back to this past offseason where, the Jays ended up adding Justin Turner. There were other DH types available who are pure DH types, and you have to work around, well, where would the reps be, et cetera. The ability to move Spencer Horwitz to second for a game or two, to move Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to third for a game or two, it's a real factor when you're building out that roster. I think the Jays would probably, like a lot of teams in 2024, prefer that DH spot to be more of like a rotating day off kind of spot, rather than something that's committed to a Brandon Belt or a Justin Turner or whatever. But Horwitz being able to show that flexibility, be average at second base, average-ish at second base, is helpful. So I don't think you lock him in as a 2B all the way moving forward. This is a team that in the offseason is going to have to explore the second base position, the third base position, the left field position, the DH position. But a guy having that flexibility allows you to look at all of those options and explore, well, okay, we're not locked in that it has to be a second baseman. Maybe we could play Horwitz there 50, 60 games and cobble that together. We are going to take a break. Ben Nicholson-Smith is on the outside of the door knocking and pounding on it. He wants to come in. He wants to talk trades. So we'll take a break. When we come back, Ben Nicholson-Smith for the hour. We're going to do deadline stuff. I also forgot to give away the tickets in this segment, so we'll give them away in the next segment when we're back from the break. Stay tuned in as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Now joined in studio for the second hour here, Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of At the Letters, of on this weekend, and I was home visiting family, sitting out on the deck, so I got the experiences of color commentary for the Sportsnet call of Jays Tigers. How was it, man?
It was a lot of fun. Worked off a little bit of rust.
This is your first one of the season, right?
First one of this season after having done a bunch in 22 and 23. Super fun. I mean, I know you've done that role as well occasionally, and it's just like you're dialed into the game. That's what I love about it. Is I think in a season like this, there can be a tendency to say like it just doesn't matter what happens in the game, and like I get that, but it's really fun to be dialed into the game watching along with Ben Schulman, and had a really good time.
And the games do matter. Like the outcome does not necessarily matter to the Toronto Blue Jays, but individual performance, guys improving, George Springer bouncing back, figuring out what you have in the young guys. All those things actually matter when we talk about resetting the table for 2025. George Springer gave Shai Davidi some pretty good quotes to that effect yesterday. Let's talk a little. We're going to mostly talk trade stuff. Let's talk a little bit about the games on the weekend. I have three kind of quick ones for you. The first is, why does Tarik Skubal fear the Blue Jays? We never get to see him.
It's true. He must be scared.
Even coming out of the All-Star break, I thought it was a lock.
I did too. I was looking forward to seeing him, actually. Yeah, he's been so, so good.
You're such a big Tigers guy, too.
Exactly. The Tigers are actually a pretty fun team this year. They wanted him to face the Guardians. He's going to pitch tonight against the Guardians. They have a ton of left-handed and switch hitters. So I get why they would do that. And I think, too, no one would say this. AJ Hinch would never say this, but they're not as scared of the Blue Jays as they are of other teams, and rightfully so.
Well, if you remember back when Alek Manoah was first coming back up, we were talking about, do you change the rotation so he can get his first start against the White Sox, which is like having a quad A start, et cetera. That's the Blue Jays now, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay, question number two. It was a very good pregame hit on Saturday. You and Arden covered a lot. I have done TV hits. Yeah. I know that you can get comfortable with it pretty quickly, and it's not as nerve-wracking once you have a couple under your belt. But the moving camera that you guys did for that one on Saturday, how awkward is that?
Honestly, I love it. Okay. I far prefer not knowing where the camera's going to be. Honestly, I like not knowing what the questions are going to be. Because otherwise, and I get it, it's part of the job. Like, but it can be a little, you know, performative if it's like, look at the camera here and then back. And I just like not knowing. It's kind of fun where it's like, it could do anything.
I got told one time, this was doing basketball ones, not to do as abrupt a camera turn. Like you start and it's like this, where two of us are talking and then it goes to one. And I would like purposely do like a hard turn to the other camera. So don't do that. So the moving camera keeps you on your toes.
Exactly.
It's like infielders practicing with one of those like Nike Sparks balls that have like the four different points and you can't exactly tell how it's going to roll to you.
Right. And I think the same goes for baseball talk, right? Like you haven't told me what we're going to talk about. Obviously, trade deadline will come up. Yeah. I kind of like that. Like in my real life, if I'm talking baseball with people, I don't have notes. I don't have, like conversation pieces I'm trying to get to. It's just, you're talking.
You're just like, hey, give me that scrap paper and can I borrow a pen? As you did before we came on here. So it's interesting being the host of the show. I will obviously check with guests. Like, do you want to know what we're talking about? And some guests, I'll send like a rundown. Like, here's what we're going to talk about. Here are my bullet points. Here's what I intend to ask. And some guests are like, nah, man, just go and just give me whatever. Okay. Question the thrice from the weekend. And then we'll talk trade stuff. George Springer, two homers and a double yesterday. His OPS plus is now basically where it was last year. So his OPS isn't as high, but relative to league average, he's up to 706, which is a little above league average. He's also in wins above replacement, basically where he was last year, a little further ahead because his defense has graded out better this year. Zips has, so Fangraph's projection system, has him for 743 OPS the rest of the way. You going higher or lower?
I'll take lower.
Okay.
Yeah. Which would be still higher than where he's at now for the season.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, what he's done has been phenomenal. I'm not trying to be a hater here.
He's at 709 for the year now, and he was 732 last year. So 743 is still saying, like, hey, he's going to keep up this hot streak more than last, you know, even last year's numbers.
And 709 as of yesterday was the exact MLB average for OPS. So that puts Springer exactly average. I think he can be above average. Whether that's 730, I don't know. 740, 750, somewhere in there, I would totally believe. I think that what he's shown has been remarkable. He deserves full credit to come back from where he was. He was accountable at the time. He said, I need to be better. He said, this isn't good enough. He answered questions from the media, and then he turned it around. I mean, that's what you want from a star player. Now, ideally, you don't want those first 2.5 months to occur the way they did in the first place. And I think that we can't totally forget about those months, just as we can't, you know, we couldn't forget about his track record in May. You have to kind of balance those two things. But yeah, what would you take?
Yeah, I mean, rest of season, I'm going to take the slight over on it.
Nice.
I think he gets OPS 750 the rest of the way. That's it's a nice round number. Yeah, I'll take a slight over on that.
Blake believes.
Yeah, we'll come back and revisit. I'm getting ready. Like, what are the positives going to be the next 2 months after we get past the trade deadline?
Yeah.
That's big among them. Okay, let's pivot to a semi-trade topic, which is Bo Bichette is going to miss multiple weeks. They're calling it a moderate right calf strain. It's the third time he's hit the IL with this calf issue this year, or third time he's had a set. Has he hit the IL all three times? Or they did an IL him around the ulcer break. So IL and then a setback, and now second IL stint. But third time he's dealt with this calf strain. Obviously, that kills the conversation around. Like, Bo Bichette was such a hard asset to value generally, but now that he's hurt, we can put a pin in that discussion for this trade deadline.
He will not be traded.
All right. So further to that, how do we contextualize what the next year or so looks like for Bo? Because those questions are going to come back up then in the offseason. They're going to come back up next trade deadline if the Jays aren't competitive again. And it's certainly possible he plays again this year. It doesn't sound like it's a season-ending thing. But he's not going to have enough time to, like, get his stat line back to a Bo Bichette stat line. How are we going to contextualize this season?
Well, I think that it's going to look like a lost season as far as you look at his baseball reference 5 years down the road, this will look like a lost season. I think that he can still turn it around as far as the direction, as far as the momentum. If he comes back, let's say for argument's sake, it's August the 15th. He gets 6 weeks in at the end of the year. And if he looks like normal Bo Bichette from that point on, playing solid defense at shortstop, hitting 290, OPS around 800, hitting for some power, which he really hasn't done in the last year or so, but if he can do that, then you're talking about someone who would have tremendous trade value in the offseason. And I fully expect that the Blue Jays at that point would explore options as far as trades involving Bo Bichette.
That'll be very interesting to watch. In the interim, we're going to get a longer look at a couple different guys here. Leo Jimenez, Ernie Clement in an expanded role. Addison Barger has been recalled. Who are you most curious about to kind of get a read on during this? Let's call it a month for lack of a firm timeline.
I would say it's Leo Jimenez. I don't know where you land on this, but I really like the way he looks defensively. I think he's really comfortable. The actions at shortstop look really smooth. He's making the plays. So I think you have a good defensive base to work with. And then offensively, he's shown some pretty good flashes at times. So I think that Jimenez is someone that, I'm not saying he's going to be, you know, even an average offensive player in the major leagues, but if he can be something solid there and provide good defense at shortstop, that's a really good player. That's a major leaguer.
So you have right now, Spencer Horwitz has been up. Leo Jimenez is up. Ernie Clement's been up the whole season. Davis Schneider is up. Addison Barger and Stuart Burrow are up. I know that we talk a lot about, like, hey, post-trade deadline, you'd get a longer look at some guys. Are we out of guys?
Pretty much. I mean, this is the Buffalo Bisons roster, more or less.
Yeah, and Nathan Lucas is the one other guy, but he's on the IL.
Right. We've seen Brian Servan up at times. Yeah, any position
Phil
player.
Clark.
Yeah.
He's leading off for the Bisons now.
There we go.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is their upper minors talent. We've talked about it for a couple years now, where Orelvis Martinez would be the other name, mm-hmm. and he would have the opportunity if he hadn't tested positive for banned substances. So yeah, I think that they continue to give these young players opportunities, and then that gives you a better idea of what you have for 2025. So that's where these next couple months, they do matter, because again, everyone expects that the Blue Jays are going to try to win next year. So can these players help a winning team?
And, you know, not only can they help a winning team, but, you know, what does the role look like, right? Like are Ernie Clement and Leo Jimenez redundant with each other? Are they competing for that 2025 bench infielder role? Can Stuart Broa be a fourth outfielder, or do you need to go and sign two outfielders instead and things like that? And I'm being a little glib. There are still guys with the Bisons that, cool, if you added them to the 40-man, it would be fun to see Damiano Palmigiani and have a Canadian up here. Sure, it would be cool to see if Will Robertson can hit home runs at this level as well. But no, Riley Tirada has had a nice year, but nobody's like knocking on the door the way that Horwitz was and earlier in the season Barger was. Like, that is not happening at AAA anymore.
Yeah, Horwitz to me was really the one where, and arguably they should have called him up earlier because his numbers were just so good. And he continues to do it here in the major leagues. I mean, there was a big moment on Sunday where Horwitz delivered.
Yep.
So this is exactly what anyone could have hoped for. He's probably the guy to me who has jumped out the most as someone that probably deserves everyday at-bats
yep.
for the foreseeable future.
And showing that little, we got asked about this in the text line before you came on, being able to show that little bit of positional flexibility, even if he's not going to be a Gold Glove second baseman, gives you some flexibility when you were talking about addressing all these holes in the offseason. The more that these guys can show something the rest of the way, the more options you have. You're not going to come into next year and say, well, Horwitz, Leo Jimenez, Davis Schneider, Addison Barger should all be everyday players. But if you are confident in a couple of those guys, then your options become, well, we could address second base, third base, left field, DH, any of those, rather than, hey, we have to address left field and that's the only spot we have, because these guys have some flexibility, because you have some ability to backfill from within.
It's honestly massive. And then the fact that Varsho can play center field, another amazing catch by Varsho yesterday. incredible grab at the wall. But, you know, this is a player who next year we're expecting to play center field.
Yes.
And with hindsight, probably should have made that move this year.
Spent that $10 million differently.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons the Blue Jays are where they are, is they just haven't had enough offense elsewhere. And really, Varsho, you know, his bat plays better in center field too.
Yeah.
Realistically, like he's a phenomenal defensive left fielder, but he doesn't hit like a left fielder. And we've seen that now for a year and a half.
Probably. I mean, really, we've seen it for his five seasons in the majors, where he has 1 year hitting above league average.
Right. And so if we're being really realistic, you can't expect Dalton Varsho to be a middle-of-the-order bat for you. So let him hit seventh and play center field and win a Gold Glove. Like, that's a good combination. Then you sign someone, in all likelihood, who plays corner outfield. But if you wanted to, you could put Davis Schneider in left field, and then you sign a second baseman, you know, if they happen to love Gleyber Torres, for example, which, you know, that's a whole other story.
But, yeah, I was going to say 2025 conversation, but it's not going to be a lot to talk about in August and September on the field. So maybe it's a August and September conversation. So one of these guys I did want to ask you about, because I think the stakes are pretty clear with, you know, Leo Jimenez, Ernie Davis, and guys like that. Addison Barger feels like he's in a weird spot right now, right?
Yes, agreed.
Okay.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, for anyone who hasn't kept up, Addison Barger's gone back down to AAA each time the Jays have optioned him. He's basically kept up what he was doing. You know, the home run power maybe isn't quite as awe-striking as it was early in the year, but draws a ton of walks, hits for extra bases, doesn't strike out very much for a guy who swings that hard every single time. And then every time he's come back up, he's looked pretty overmatched. Some of that is the jump is hard. That's just the reality of it. But he is almost 25, and this was his, you know, third time getting at least a cup of coffee at AAA. What do you make of, again, small sample, et cetera, but the fact that he has struggled so much when he has gotten the calls back up, and they haven't, you know, made an effort to get him in there every day like they have with some of the other guys?
Yeah, it just hasn't been a priority to get him in because other guys have been hitting better. So it also now needs to be a priority for the organization to continue to showcase Kevin Kiermaier, Justin Turner, Danny Jansen. And once he comes back, if it is before the deadline, IKF. You have to show that these guys are healthy and capable of contributing, because they might be able to bring you something back. And it's not going to be massive, I don't think, for those players. But you can't just put Kevin Kiermaier on the bench and not play him at all. You can't do that with Justin Turner either, despite the fact that Turner is, I want to say, 3 for his last 38. It's been a tough stretch.
We're back here.
Yeah. It's not looking good for Turner, but still play him. Give him a chance to get out of it. Give him a chance to, with pro scouts in attendance, which, you know, there are a lot of pro scouts watching that series, Tigers, Jays, yeah, as you would expect. But lots
of Flaherty and Kikuchi back to back.
Right. That's perfect. So lots of contending teams were there watching. And so you want, in front of that audience, you want Kiermaier and Turner to show off what they can do. Therefore, Barger's on the bench.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because I did want to ask you what the weekend was like. I wasn't at any of the games, but you were down there, obviously doing radio and your pregame hits and stuff like that. There are a lot of pro scouts in attendance, and this is a fascinating time for that, because obviously teams have the ability to watch video every single game from far away from 30 different angles on the MLB research tool. We have all the StatCast data and things like that. But teams obviously, and I think correctly, still put a ton of value in being able to get a close set of eyes on that guy, talk to people around the ballpark, things like that. Just how pivotal are those pro scout visits?
I think it's super interesting because, as you said, you can know exactly what a guy's throwing down to the RPM, down to the every single rotation of the baseball. You can know what someone's throwing. So you don't need it from that standpoint. You could watch Yusei Kikuchi on video and say, all right, this guy has dynamic stuff. He's great two times through. I don't know if we necessarily want him third time through, but he's a number three starter for us. Definitely worth acquiring. That is how I would report my report on Yusei Kikuchi, yeah, by the way. I think he looked good. Not phenomenal, but very good.
My report would be you should trade several elite prospects for him.
There we
That's
go.
That's the report.
No bias at all from Blake. Nope. He's just totally right down the middle. So the scouts, though, it's telling in this era, because, you know, you see scouts from some analytically minded teams. Most teams, of course, are analytically minded in this day and age. But
the good teams do both.
Exactly.
They do both well.
Exactly. And I think there's a lot to be gained from it. I mean, you can just get a sense of, you know, the body language coming off the mound. You can get a sense of preparation, how they're going about their routines. Even something like this, if you're a pro scout there, let's say your assignment is Flaherty and Kikuchi. Those are the headliners, right? But you're also going to see IKF doing warm-ups on the field. Mm-hmm. He was running, and to me, he looked pretty comfortable. So, okay, maybe IKF is someone. He's actually recovering really well. He's moving well. That's not going to appear in a box score. That's not going to be on Baseball Savant anywhere.
It's going to be a tweet from Yu Arden just saying, yeah, he's doing baseball activities and feels good.
But I might not even tweet it.
And
they might not follow me.
And what does that mean? He's following you.
Well, I know. Yeah. Some of them do. Some of them don't.
Burners.
But yes, there are. Oh, there are so many burners. GM burners. You know this.
Yes. This is an NBA special.
Yeah, exactly. Many a burner out there. I have no doubt about that. But it's a different thing for them to, with their professional experience, to put eyes on a player doing that. So they're not just reading a tweet from me. They're seeing, oh, I actually saw IKF. He looks comfortable. Great. Or I saw Jimmy Garcia, and he was completely confident as ever when he was striking out the side, throwing all his pitches. And you know, you get a read on the vibe.
Yeah, and I think that is important. In addition to, I'm sure they talk to a lot of people, and the Jays are obviously going to manage information in a certain way, but those conversations can still be revealing and potentially helpful. Okay, so I know that you're around the Blue Jays, and you and Shai and Arden do a lot of reporting from this team, but I know you also talk to a lot of people around the league. We are 8 days out from the trade deadline. There are, in the American League, 10 teams within 6 games of a playoff spot, plus the defending champion Rangers, who are 7.5 out. So, in theory, 11 teams that are still competing for a playoff spot. Now, how you feel about the Tigers, the Rangers, whatever, but there are 11 teams who could potentially consider themselves in it. In the National League, 13 teams are within 4 games. So that is 24 teams that, at least based on the games behind, and in the case of Texas, the fact that you have a bajillion-dollar payroll and are the defending champs, who could consider themselves winners or buyers. on the Fangraphs odds, there are 22 teams with 8% playoff odds or higher. So teams that haven't hit that threshold that you and I have talked about before of like, oh, it's pack it in time in terms of your playoff odds. What are you hearing in terms of like, are we close to the market establishing? Have the Jays been active? I'd imagine like of the selling to the clear sellers, Colorado, Miami, the White Sox, Oakland, the Angels, and the Jays. Those are the six pretty clear sellers. Yep. The Jays are by far the, like yes, there is Garrett Crochet, there's Miller in Oakland, but the Jays are by far the most tradable, like marketable assets among that group. Are you starting to hear things pick up now?
So it's really funny. I agree with you that among those teams, the Jays are the best because I don't think the A's trade Mason Miller anyway. This is the time of year where teams just wait. And this is why everything happens at the deadline. But because there are so many teams that are clustered right around that 500 mark, what happens in the next week is massive. This is the time of year that there's probably, short of the last weekend of the season, this is scoreboard watching time. This is where it really matters. Because take Texas. They lost their series on the weekend. Let's say they go 3-0 in their series this week. Okay, all of a sudden now they're two games under.
And they've got the White Sox.
White Sox this week. And they have another favorable opponent this weekend because they play the Blue Jays. So
I mean, the Jays, they dropped 2-3 to the Tigers. They got a tank against the Rays and the Rangers here. Get more buyers in the market.
Well, honestly, I mean, you're never going to tank. You're always going to try to win the games in front of you. I know you know that. But I think that it wouldn't be the worst thing if the Blue Jays, I hate to say it, but if they went 1-5 this week. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Some of these teams, they might be, okay, so basically the standings impact things, right? So a team goes 5-0, great, now they're in it. They go 0-5, now they're out of it. The Rangers go 0-5, they're selling.
Right.
Even if the Rangers go 3-3, I think they sell because it's going to be a tough road for them. And it's not a good thing for the Blue Jays if the Rangers sell.
Right, because then there's another team with as many.
Exactly, and the Rangers have legit pitching. So you think about Leclerc, you think about Robertson, you think about Kirby Yates. That's the relief side. Now all of a sudden that's competition for Jimmy Garcia. Then you get to the starting side.
John Gray.
John Gray, Ovaldi, Scherzer. And that's a lot of pitch. Heaney. There are a lot of actually pretty good starting pitchers that Texas can throw out there that would really change the market. So if you're the Jays, you want Texas to sweep the White Sox. And, you know, maybe, you know, we'll see what happens this weekend. Wouldn't be the worst thing if the Rangers swept the Jays and decide to buy and decide to push. So that's that dynamic. I think with a team like the Tigers, my understanding is the Tigers could go 4-2 this week and still sell.
Okay.
I don't think they're trading Scooble, but they're trading Flaherty.
Right. Which I think makes sense.
Yeah.
Because even if they can get into the fringes of the playoff picture, like they're probably, I mean, they're just not there yet.
Yeah.
Right. It's been a fun season and everything, but
it's tough to, it's just tough. Like I think it's similar to the
Guardians and who knows?
Right. And then that's where you get the temptation.
Yeah.
And it makes things tough.
The other one that's fun is like, what if Cincinnati sweeps Atlanta? Because Cincinnati's only four games out, but they're the one team that the Fangraphs odds are like, no, you're fake.
Yeah.
But like if you're suddenly within one game, and Atlanta is a super interesting buyer because like they keep stacking the injury. Like they signed Whit Merrifield before came on to a major league contract.
Yeah.
Because like the team they're chasing in the division was like, we're done. Sorry, Whit.
Yeah.
And then the Braves are like, please, like this is how bad a shape we're in. Like that's the other element to this next week is like a good team getting a little bit more desperate.
And
Yankees have the second worst record in baseball over the last like 20 days.
Yeah. They've got to figure some stuff out. But with Atlanta, I think, could they make a call on IKF? Like in an alternate universe.
Could the Yankees make a call on IKF, a guy they know well?
Sure. And IKF can handle New York.
IKF and Chad Green back to the Yankees?
Honestly, it fits.
Tidy work, $18 million off the books for next year?
It fits. And this is where there's more nuance to, okay, because, you know, clearly the Jays, like I would be so stunned if they trade Vlad Guerrero Jr.
Right.
I really don't see that happening because the belief is that they want to win next year. In 2025. So Vlad Jr., he's their best player by such a wide margin. Like when you think about who the second best player on the Jays is, it's not even close. Vlad Jr. has been so much more impactful as a hitter. And moving forward, you have to be really encouraged by what he can offer. So he's there. Clearly the rental players, Jimmy Garcia, Yusei Kikuchi, Justin Turner, Kevin Kiermaier, those players are available. That's no secret. And then I actually think, too, that even though Chad Green and IKF are under team control, under contract for one more year, I think in the right deal, you get back enough that helps you, that's reasonably close to the major leagues. I don't see a reason not to listen on those.
Well, the thing is like, I like both of those guys. Chad Green's 5 save out yesterday. Great stuff. IKF, been like low-key the best Blue Jay to talk to this year in the clubhouse and stuff like that. But you can, if you are a good front office, you can find Chad Green relief performance for less than $10.5 million. You can find IKF, you know, you should be able to find that for $7.5 million again if you re-enter the market. So, you know, it's obviously tougher to have to do that again and go with someone you don't know than someone you do know. But, like, those are the type of moves where, yeah, I'm with you. I don't really see those as, like, this idea that the Jays are only trading pieces who aren't a part of 2025. I don't really see – IKF and Chad Green are the two that I'm like, okay, I don't really consider them that. I think they're kind of their own tier.
Exactly. Now, the tier above that is your Gausman Bassett. And I'd listen if I was the Jays.
Well, I did want to ask you about this. So let's IKF and Green, you're firmly like, yeah, if it's the right deal – and I'm not saying you're clearing the books because the money is bad. Like $18 million for those two is like fine, but you think you can, you should, if you're a good front office, you can repeat the performance of those two guys with $18 million in free agency. So if you can get assets back, go for it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Because then you get in free agency, you get the players again, and then you get some prospects, some guys who can help you. Or maybe it's just a reliever with, I don't know, two more years of control. That's less established than Chad Green. Like that would be a fine trade.
Yeah. Okay. So the guys who are a level above that then are the three veteran pitchers that are into their 30s and have terms. So Chris Bassett will be 36 next year and makes $21 million in the final year of his contract. Kevin Gausman will be 34 next season and has two more years at $22 million per. Jose Berríos will be 30 next year. He has 4 years left at just under $19 million per. He also has an opt-out after 2026. Complicated contract, but let's say 4 years left at $19 million per. Are you listening on any of those three? Are you listening on all three? Where are you at on those three if you're the Blue Jays?
I would listen on all three. I mean, I just think that as an organization at this point, they don't have a good major league team and they don't have a good farm system. We've talked about this at length, but they need to aspire to greater heights. And to me, that means being open-minded. So that means if someone really wants to talk about Chris Bassett, I don't think that you can be in a position right now to say, no, we're so convicted that, you know, he absolutely has to be part of this plan. I think you have to listen. And if you can get back, let's say it's a controllable starting pitcher for 1 year, year and a half of Chris Bassett, I think you have to be open to that.
Paul Skeens, there you go.
Yeah.
Pirates are another interesting, like, buy team, because obviously they're not good enough. They're probably not good enough to go on a World Series run, because I would have said the Diamondbacks were not good enough last year too. But like, you have Paul Skeens and Jared Jones in a play in a wild card series.
That's it. And that is what takes me back to the Tigers too, because Skubal and Flaherty, if they were actually to hold on to those guys and make the playoffs, that's pretty dynamic.
I'm not as big a Flaherty guy as the market. Like, I believe more the last 2 years of Flaherty.
Really?
Than this year of Flaherty. But yes, you have Skubal. I mean, who arguably been the best pitcher in the American League this year, starting a wild card game for
you.
He
has been, I think.
I mean, he didn't get that All-Star start.
But I mean, the Tigers' offense isn't good enough. I don't think the Pirates' offense is good enough either. Those teams,
win a wild card series, for some of those teams that have been in the, like, out of the playoffs for so long and, like, just, like, in the competitive wilderness for so long. There's maybe some value in that.
And that's what MLB wants. That's why they added those wild cards, is they want to have this competition and this illusion that anything could happen. I don't think the Tigers and Pirates have enough offense to win the World Series. I just don't. I think that you need to have a much more balanced team. So I actually would endorse the Tigers selling Flaherty, and I would endorse, I don't know what the Pirates have to sell, but you know, I'm not saying the Pirates should go all in either.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is the year after, like, somehow it feels like you and I have talked about David Bednar as a trade deadline target, like, 30 years in a row, but he's still under control at a minimum contract. maybe this is the year Bednar finally gets traded. Let me guess, he's not having a 5.13 ERA. Of course, this is why you trade your relievers,
but he's
even
been great.
If they're under control. I know he's been great lately.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe they can flip Chapman for a frontline starting pitcher, just like the Royals did.
Korakins. Yeah, there you go. Okay, so back to the pitchers, though. So with Bassett, Gausman, Berríos, I'm with you. You got to listen. If someone blows you away, if you can swap that out. And like Chris Bassett, I love Chris Bassett. I love talking to him, love watching him pitch. He is going to be 36 next year. And, you know, maybe this is the time. The thing that is, the more we go down this road, the thing that gets tougher is you have to replace these guys for next year and get better, right? Like, this is the thing I keep grappling with. Like, we know why they're going to compete again in 2025. It's the wild card era. The Pirates and Tigers can find their way to a playoff spot. A team that spends like the Jays should be able to as well. But the more of these pieces you sell when you're already bad, the harder the path is to competing again next year. And I think the starting rotation is the one area where, again, I'm with you that you listen. And, you know, Gausman and Bassett at their ages are probably guys you should be realistic about of, you know, is he going to repeat this performance? Is the Gausman decline that he showed, you know, is that starting to be real? Is he just an average starter now, et cetera? But also, like, imagine you trade Bassett and Gausman. You got to replace two rotation pieces for $43 million that are better than Gausman and Bassett. It gets a little tough. So that's where I understand a tiny bit if they want to compete in 2025, the hesitancy with the starters.
I get it too. And I won't, honestly, if the Jays don't trade Gausman and Bassett, I'm not going to sit here and criticize it and say that that's like some fatal error.
Just you should explore it.
Yeah, exactly. Same with Danny Jansen, by the way. I don't think Danny Jansen is getting traded.
I think probably he has hurt his chances, or the value there is certainly not where it was when we started these conversations.
You know, OPS of 900 in the beginning of June, and it's like 440 since then. So, yeah. So, I can't sit here and criticize not trading Danny Jansen just under those circumstances. What I would criticize if they don't trade Jimmy Garcia or Yusei Kikuchi is a total missed opportunity. It would be a complete error, unforced error on the part of the front office. But I do expect both of those guys to be traded. So, I think with Gausman and Bassett, what would have to happen is if you do trade one of them, then you're also trading that salary for next year. So that's 20 more million.
Yeah.
So let's say now we're expecting they have 50 million to spend this offseason on free agents.
Now it's 70.
Now it's 70. And you have to do it. You have to actually spend that money. You can't do that just to save money next year. It has to be something where you're signing guys. You're signing, maybe it's a, you know, Jack Flaherty. Maybe, you know, who knows who you sign. You try to, maybe you re-sign Kikuchi. You got to use that money.
Yeah, it's a... And it's tough, but it's doable. That's the job.
Yeah.
That's the job. And if you are a top 7 or 8 payroll, that's supposed to be the thing that helps you. This is the benefit of, you know, nobody wants a year like this. But if you have to have one, well, you have money to go re-enter the market with this offseason. Let's take a break. When we come back, going to give away some Jays tickets for this weekend and going to continue to talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith about trade deadline stuff as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Ben Nicholson-Smith still alongside me. I'm going to forget to do this at the end of the show if I don't do it right now. So, Ben, bear with me for a second. I'm going to give away some tickets. The Blue Jays Caribbean Carnival returns to Rogers Center on Friday, July 26th, with live music, dance performances, and plenty of activations around the ballpark. To help kick this off, we'll be giving away a pair of tickets to Friday's game against the Texas Rangers. To enter for a chance to win, text today's code word Caribbean to 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. Again, today's code word is Caribbean. Text us into 590-590 right now to enter for your chance to win tickets to the game on Friday, July 26th. We're giving away another pair of tickets tomorrow, so be sure to tune in. And I don't know who goes through these things, but I would guess that Caribbean gets spelt wrong a lot, and I don't know if that disqualifies you or not. I could see a lot of people doing double R, single B, or double R, double B, but it's single R, double B. For those of you who want to spell it correctly in the context. Ben, your mic is off. The Rangers series, we kind of touched on it there. Last year, the Rangers series felt like a huge part of the season because they got swept over four games, and it was just like the writing could not have been on the wall more that they were not a good enough team, despite the fact that they were probably going to make a playoff spot. And this time, it's, you know, instead of being the big uh-oh series right after the deadline, the Rangers could just, like, put a nail in this thing.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that a nail in the sense of, like, to me, the nail's already in the Jays. But
yeah, I mean, I think so. But, like, they could, I don't know. Yeah, the nail's in. I don't know what I'm. Yeah. I was trying to find a pivot there off the Rangers, trying to promote a series down at Rogers Center.
It will be a fun
trying
series.
Trying to pay the bills here.
There's a cool hat giveaway on that Friday with the ticket with the game that you were giving away tickets for. But yeah, to me the nails are already in the Jays. I think that it's just their playoff odds are what 0 point
one point something today. I think. Yeah. Neon hats on Friday.
Yes. Always fun.
Nice. Yeah. That'll be fun. Hopefully the baseball is some semblance of fun as well. Okay, so a couple small things from the weekend. We talked about a couple of them there. Eric Swanson's back. What did you... I mean, I guess this is kind of like you just have the needs, but Zach Pop hadn't been terrible. What do you make of him being back?
I think it's... You want to see what you have because best case scenario, he comes back for a week... absolutely shoves and a team says we want him, we're gonna roster him and we're gonna acquire him. I don't think that's gonna happen. I think he looked actually pretty solid. He was throwing strikes, he was in the zone, and it was a 1-2-3 inning when he pitched on Saturday. So that is a success. That's definitely a step in the right direction for Eric Swanson. I don't think that would be enough to really give him any trade value. It's funny because that same game Jimmy Garcia comes back, strikes out the side, looks absolutely nasty, stuff in the upper 90s, starting pitcher's arsenal, throwing it all for strikes. That, to me, is the kind of outing that says, okay, he's back. Like, we are going to, this is a guy who should get a lot in trades. If you're one of those pro scouts watching that outing, that's exactly what you want to see.
You had a pretty good weekend as far as the Jays' reliever value is concerned because, like you said, Eric Swanson came back, and maybe you can't get much. You know, the Jays gave up nothing for Yasis Cabrera last year. You know, so maybe it's, I mean, you probably get nothing to, Eric Swanson at least doesn't make any money. So there's that. But yeah, you're probably, it's also, I don't know, maybe you're just getting him up here to get him up here because you're going to trade guys away and someone's got to fill those bullpen rooms.
Right.
Like, it's not like you've got, I mean, you've got a bunch, Zach Pop, Jose Kwas, Yuri Rodriguez, Brandon Eisert. Those are the guys you probably call up after you trade relievers away just because they're on the 40-man. But they're not exciting names. But Jimmy Garcia came back and had a good outing. Chad Green looked very, very good. I guess Trevor Richards would be the guy that over the last little bit you're a little concerned about. Would you imagine, given the body of work, there's still a market for Trevor Richards?
I don't know. I will say this. If I was a contending team, wouldn't trade for him.
Really?
Wouldn't want him. He has not pitched well enough in the last 3 weeks to say that this guy is going to be the target. That this is going to be the player that I'm going to target. And I don't mean to, you know, overlook what Trevor Richards has done in his career with the Blue Jays. He's been great, and he's been a really, really important reliever for them. At the same time, if I'm a contender right now, based on what Trevor Richards is throwing right now, and it wasn't just the grand slam to Jake Rogers, it was what happened after and what happened before. When you look at his last string of outings, he has really struggled. So there's no way if you're, you know, a special advisor to a GM on a contending team that you're going to say, of all the relievers in baseball, this is the guy we should get.
14 runs over his last 9 innings, 11 of them earned, and 3 home runs in there. And when this blip first happened, I was like, well, I was trying to be fair to him. And obviously there's a healthy level of respect we all have for Trevor Richards. And I think that his ERA over his 3 years with the Blue Jays is not really indicative of his value, given that his ERA probably wouldn't have been as high if they didn't have to also use him as a starter. Yeah. And then you've pitched 70 innings, but like, I think he's fourth in all of Major League Baseball in relief pitching innings over the last 4 years.
Yeah.
So like there's obviously a toll to that. But also there is potentially a toll into the quality of pitching. You know, like, it's not just a toll to your numbers. You might just be like, he's already thrown 50 innings this year.
Right. You know, I'm not saying he has zero value, but he, to me, on a contending team, he's the 6th, 7th reliever, mm-hmm. something like that. Jimmy Garcia could be the best reliever on a team that reaches the World Series. He's elite. He's really good.
Yenesis Cabrera's also been real good of late. You think anyone would take a flyer on him as a second lefty in the bend?
Absolutely.
He's got that ERA down to 3.55 now.
Yenesis Cabrera has some nasty stuff. He doesn't know where it's going, but it is really good. And yeah, I think that I think contending teams will look at that and say, yeah, we take a shot here.
Okay. Okay, interesting. So you mentioned you don't think Danny Jansen gets traded. Is that purely just a function of the value, 404 OPS since June 2nd?
That's part of it. But honestly, the biggest part for me is looking at what teams are contending. And I just don't see, maybe I'm not looking hard enough. Maybe you
or one of our... No, we did the exercise.
Right. Like, what contender needs a catcher? The Cubs aren't really a contender. So I don't see that as a fit. The Padres, they have Higashioka. So I don't really see the fit. And I think with catcher, it's not like every team needs eight catchers. Every team needs eight relievers. So relievers move all the time. Every team needs five starters. So starters need move all the time. Every team needs one to two catchers. So that just stifles the movement that might otherwise exist. And I think if a catcher moves this deadline, it's probably Carson Kelly. It's probably not Danny Jansen.
Yeah, Carson Kelly, who's been a nice story here for your Tigers. yeah, and then even some of the teams that, like, you sort the, hey, what teams have gotten what production from the catcher spot, the ones who are in it and have gotten poor production, it's a lot of, like, guys you think will be better. Like, yeah. Like Texas probably isn't giving up. Texas probably isn't addressing the catcher position. Probably not. Baltimore probably isn't addressing the catcher position.
No shot.
Probably not something they're going to do. Yeah, maybe Pittsburgh, but given the Joey Bart, Henry Davis.
I just don't see the Pirates giving up anything of substance for Danny Jansen. Exactly. Could they give the Blue Jays a lowball offer that's like a one class A reliever? Yeah, but then you decline. Because what's the point?
And this is the thing. When Danny Jansen was hitting much better, the conversation began, and this is the conversation around Kikuchi, is the prospect return that you get has to be better than the comp pick that you'd get if you gave him a qualifying offer and he signed elsewhere. That's very much still the case with Yusei Kikuchi. I don't know that Danny Jansen gets a qualifying offer.
No,
a one-year, like, $20 million deal.
He would not.
Yeah. So then you don't even have... So that's where I guess a team could lowball you and be like, well, you're not going to qualify him. So it's either this or nothing.
Yeah. And I think, there's obviously a sliding scale. There's a point where you make that move. But I don't think if you're the Blue Jays, you're in a rush to have Brian Servin catching three times a week the rest of the year.
Yeah. And, that has an impact on Kirk. It has an impact on your pitchers as well. I mean, there's still a chance they re-sign Danny Jansen as well, which is just a beyond fascinating free agent discussion to have. Like, I have no clue what his value is going to be, given how weird the catcher market always is. And then given that he was like the best hitting catcher in the league for 3 years in a part-time role because he wasn't healthy. And then now he's healthy and not hitting well. I don't know, man. I don't know how you value him.
I still look at Mitch Garver.
Yeah.
Yeah. 25 over two.
Yeah.
But
Mitch Garver's probably a guy right now who you could take, like, when Danny Jansen was hitting really well, that was something you and I kicked around. It's like, well, maybe Mitch Garver comes back and you save the Mariners a little bit of money. And then that addresses part of your catching situation. Like, Mitch Garver signed that deal and then was immediately put into a pile of like, well, you could probably get him because the Mariners are cheap and he's not that good.
Right. Ty France too, apparently on waivers.
I imagine he'll... It's a weird one where they did the waivers before the DFA, but it's this is not the Kevin Kiermaier waivers where they would keep him on the roster. He's going to be gone.
So they need offense.
Yeah.
But they're also, the Mariners are also falling out of it. So what they do is kind of
10 game lead squandered in 20 games.
Right.
Crazy.
So it's kind of flipped now where the Astros are the clear buyers.
Yeah. Which we kind of figured all along, and also that was like what the Jays were. But the Astros did the thing that when we were sitting here in late May, being like, it's not early, but like you could still do it. The Astros did it.
Yep.
The Jays did not.
The Mets did that to an extent.
Yeah.
The Cardinals did that for a while. Like, yeah, it does happen. Just not to the Blue Jays.
Yeah, not this year anyway. Okay, so are the Jays going to, like, if Danny Jansen is too weird to find a landing spot for and the value has eroded some, Kevin Kiermaier passed through waivers, maybe you could get something for him if you eat the salary or something like that. Justin Turner is back to not playing particularly well. Are any position players gone off this team at the deadline?
Well, I still think they trade Kiermaier.
Okay.
And I still think that they could trade Turner.
They're just eating the money.
Yeah. I think like with Turner or with Kiermaier, what the outright waivers showed us was that No team values him at his full salary.
Right.
But if the Blue Jays take on, let's say for argument's sake, half of the salary, then maybe they do get a little prospect back. Maybe they take on the full salary, cash considerations going to the other team, and they get actually kind of an interesting prospect back. You're not getting anyone's top prospect, that's clear, but you could get someone who has some potential. So Kiermaier, I don't know. If I'm a contending team, I look at Kevin Kiermaier with his defense and his base running. I still want that player on my roster as a fourth outfielder.
Yeah.
So I think
the Jays have Bradley Zimmer on the roster for a whole season. Kevin Kiermaier is a better version of that role, right?
Yeah. So I see him potentially moving. Jansen, I don't. Turner, I think 50-50. This is speculation, by the way. Yeah. I'm not saying that this is definitive because, again, so much depends on what happens elsewhere, right?
Like a catcher gets hurt and suddenly.
Exactly.
Danny Jansen gets dealt.
Exactly. Like Ozzie Albies gets hurt. Boom. Now maybe that creates a market in a way that it didn't before. So this might impact IKF. Like I could actually see IKF moving as we touched on before. The pitchers, I see Richards. I don't know what to predict there. Jimmy Garcia, Yusei Kikuchi, they need to be moved.
Okay. So the other Kiermaier question, and we kicked this around on the show when it happened, when the waivers thing, but part of that idea then, or at least part of what it sparked in me was like, okay, well, there's a scenario. It's not likely given how far away the Jays are, but there is a scenario where instead of prospects, they valued getting below the competitive balance tax because of what that does to the compensation pick you have to pay for signing a free agent, the compensation pick you get back if you qualify one of your free agents and they sign elsewhere, and the fact that, you know, there'll be a 3-year repeater next year, so they'll be paying 50% tax surcharge instead of the 20% if they got out and then got back in. Do you think that's on their radar at all, or is not enough salary coming off the book? Keeping in mind for the audience that you prorate that, right? So if you trade $10.5 million Kevin Kiermaier, that is not the 10.5 you get under. That's 4.5 at this point.
Right. So you kind of have to trade 30 in full year salary. Yeah. Is it on their radar? Absolutely. Of course. Is it a driving force behind their decisions? I don't think so.
I hope not.
Yeah, I don't think so. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, there are a lot of layers to this, but the willingness on the part of ownership to spend has clearly been there to be at a luxury tax level each of the last 2 years. They're not trying to save every penny they can. They're trying to field a good team. And that hasn't happened. So they need to look in the mirror and they need to make adjustments and make trades and change some things. To be in a better spot, but financially they don't seem to be restricted in the same way that other small market teams would be.
Right. So for context, if you were to trade Kikuchi, Turner, Chad Green, IKF, and Kiermaier, you're looking at over $50 million, and the prorated amount would get the Jays below the CBT. You could still eat some of the salary in that. And again, the idea would not be save our bosses money and improve our share price. It would be, we'll roll that over into next year's budget. The money you spend and go into the tax goes further because you're only paying a 20% tax instead of 50% tax. But I think, yeah, my feel on it and what it seems like you're saying is if they got really close to it, maybe it becomes a motivating fact. If you trade Kikuchi and Garcia and don't take any major league salary back and suddenly you're close, then it's a motivating factor. Maybe even pull the Angels move from last year.
Yeah, I completely agree with all that. And at that point, let's say it's August the 20th and Trevor Richards has had a renaissance and he's pitched well for 3 weeks. Just put him on waivers, let him go for nothing. Instead of the prospect, you duck onto the CBT. Great, you're good to go. But I think at this point, you're not sitting here saying we absolutely must get rid of salary. I think it's more about restocking the system. I think it's more we need to get some young players.
Not a great system, Ben.
Well, I haven't seen any of the midseason rankings yet. I don't think they're out. As far as I'm aware,
they are not. But multiple guests have told me the Jays will continue to rank in the bottom third.
Right. You just had Keith Law on, right?
Yes. And Jeff Ponce of Baseball America has said similarly. I mean, Keith seemed to like the Blue Jays draft fine. Like Yesavage slipping was a positive. Liked some of their like fifth, sixth, seventh round picks, but overall was like kind of a conservative draft, which I think you kind of had to do to get the Yesavage money where it needed to be. But
yeah, I think their draft was good based on what I've heard. And I've been critical of their drafts from 16 to 23. But from what I've heard, their 24 draft was good. That'll take a lot of time to see. But from people outside the Jays organization, they like the picks. Of course, people internally like the picks as well, as you'd expect. So I should hope so.
I hope so.
So, that's definitely the case. But yeah, you know, we'll see where it goes.
All right. We've got just 30 seconds left here. So very, very quickly, another setback for Joey Votto. We ever see him in a Blue Jays uniform?
Man, it was getting close. It was really getting close. I hope so. I mean, this is a lost season for the Jays. If there's ever a time to do it, it's this year, right? I hope it happens. Will it happen? I mean, they're going to have opportunity too. I'm going to say yes. Okay. I'm still going to say yes.
Thank you to BNS. Thanks to Keith Law. Thanks to everyone else behind the glass. We'll talk to you guys at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.